Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden and D. Quillen, your hosts for the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Hi, and welcome to episode 226 of the Inexplicable Dumb Show. I'm John Malden, and T. Quillen will be joining me here shortly in just a few seconds. This is our first episode on our annual SETC coverage. This is the 62nd annual SETC, and we have a great interview with Ben Cameron, the Distinguished Career Award winner for this year. And we'll get right into that in just a few seconds.
Hey, Putz, get off your fat tookus and do something. I'm tired of yous laying around complaining about this and that. Forget about it. It's all you say. You bum.
Shut up already, Frank. Oh, God, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. I'm sorry. He gets wound up around the first of the month. You know, when you're supposed to pay the rent.
Now, give Frank a big tip. Hear about auditions, booking gigs, and other theater work around the South. Next.
Hey, T.
Yes, sir.
We're starting our coverage of the 62nd annual SETC.
Wow.
Which runs March 2nd through the 6th in the year of our Lord, 2011.
Wow.
We want to talk to, first we have a keynote speaker we're going to talk to, Ben Cameron, who is receiving the Distinguished Career Award.
Wow.
And he's the program director of the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, among other things. So he's on the line. So hi there, Ben. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm swell.
doing great.
I'm doing better now that it's working. Right? So you're the program director for the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which I understand is like a $13 million grant foundation, correct? And it supplies all the arts. Is that what I understand?
Actually, our foundation as a whole is significantly bigger than $13 million. The $13
right.
million is what we dedicate to the arts specifically. Doris Duke in her will actually charged us with taking care of actors, singers, dancers, and musicians in the public performance and presentation of their work. In intersection with what she really cared about in her life, what that means is that we dedicate all of our resources in the arts program to artists who work in theater, contemporary dance, or jazz, and the organizations who nurture, produce, and present those artists. So we don't do museums, we don't do symphonies or ballets or classical ballets or operas, we don't do literature. There's a lot we don't do. Our purview is pretty narrow, but theater is a significant portion of our portfolio.
I'm assuming on a national, international scale, right?
It is. We do fund primarily nationally United States organizations, and there is that restriction in the will. There's an additional small pot of money off to the side called the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, which reflected her love of Eastern cultures. And we do have a part of our portfolio that's designed to encourage American understanding of Muslim cultures. Some of those beneficiaries clearly involve bringing artists from other countries to the United States to increase American understandings of those nations.
Cool.
Wow.
That's intense. That's cool stuff, though.
Yeah. It's a pretty great and remarkable foundation in its way, and it really does reflect the vision and the singularity and the sort of pioneering spirit of who Doris Duke was when she was alive. I always regret never having known her or never having had the chance to meet her, but she was clearly a woman who was a visionary in her time. Before anyone really appreciated who Martha Graham was, Doris would send the car to Graham and say, come out to the farm in New Jersey and I want you to give me dance class. And when everyone thought jazz was sort of not particularly the polite form of music to listen to, she was very close with jazz composers like Mary Lou Williams, who actually wrote a song called Miss Dee Dee, which stands for Doris Duke. And at a time when everybody else was collecting Louis XIV furniture and cupids with clocks in their stomachs, she was collecting Islamic art from all over the world. And in fact, built a house that you can visit in Honolulu, Hawaii, where major portions of the house are Persian tile from the 14th century or Turkish inlay from the 17th century or, you know, from all over the world. She was a remarkable, remarkable woman.
What an incredible life. I mean, that's phenomenal. That's awesome.
And what a phenomenal organization to be a part of. Too.
Now
that seems like so exciting. I mean, I guess you have to see a lot of art in your job post, I guess.
Oh, it's
right?
One of the great glories of what I get to do. I am at the theater or at a jazz concert or at a dance concert probably 4 or 5 times a week. And trying to keep really abreast of what Doris Duke would have cared about, which primarily was creation of new work or new forms of pushing the envelope. So a lot of the work I get to see is experimental, even though clearly I also go to a number of, you know, standard things, and I continue to be on the Tony Awards nominating committee, and so I see everything that goes through Broadway, and so I have a great life. I'm very conscious of how blessed I am to be in the job I'm in.
No, what's the... we don't have to go into a great detail, but basically it would be what, an application and then an invitation for a viewing? I mean, how would an artist, I guess it would need to present some sort of work to the foundation to get some grant money going or something. So how, you know, nutshell version, how does that process work?
You know, one of the decisions the board made early on was they wanted to maximize all of the money going to grants recipients or artists in this case. And so they deliberately created a vision where the administrative structure would be extremely lean and small. Even within the few fields that we fund, there are more than 10,000 organizations that theoretically could knock on our door for support. Hmm. And clearly, that's more than, without a huge infrastructure, we could be responsive to. The arts program staff is a total of 3 people here.
Wow.
So what we traditionally do is we create large funding initiatives that we then make multi-million-dollar grants to another organization to run on our behalf. In the dance world, for example, there's a thing called the National Dance Project, which supports the creation, the commission of new dance works, and the touring of those works all over the United States. We make a grant in excess of $1 million a year to the National Dance Project. Individual dance companies apply to NDP, or National Dance Project, about the work they would like to create. They also send work samples of their work, and then a panel of artists that are convened from all over the country come together, review the samples, and make recommendations for which would be the most important works for the field as a whole to see encouraged. And so we tend to work through that intermediary-driven structure where we create the initiatives, but then other people make the specific selections of who gets the money.
Right. Gotcha.
Now, the $10,000 question here, or the $13 million question, whichever way you want to put it, how have you seen, and this is, because this is the question that's on everybody's tongues, this, you know, after the last several years, how have you seen the economy and the downturn in the economy impact what you do with these decisions of awarding these grants? Have you seen any impact that way? I mean, or how has that impacted? Everybody's seen the impact. How has that impacted you?
You know, I think the economy's had a particularly devastating impact on a lot of the arts around the country. And this is a little bit of a two-part answer. On the one hand, for foundations such as ours, the downturn in the economy meant that we lost a major portion of our portfolio. Foundations like ours tend to have large investment portfolios that are invested. And basically, we're required by law to give away a certain percentage of our assets in a given year. We have to give away more than 5% of what we own. Mm-hmm. At the worst of the economic downturn, we lost $800 million from our portfolio. Mm. And what that meant for us was our giving budget in the arts fell from just over $18 million a year to just over $13 million. So suddenly, $5 million was yanked out of the economy right away for artists, and that pattern repeated itself at virtually all the foundations around the country. Yeah. As we're seeing right now, the state arts agencies are feeling the pinch of the state economies, and if you've been following the news, the governors of Texas, South Carolina, Kansas, among others, have called for the elimination of the state arts agencies in their states. And now, as of today anyway, the House of Representatives had voted to cut the National Endowment for the Arts by 25% for next year, which was above and beyond President Obama's recommendation, which was for an 11% cut. So a lot of the contributed revenues to the arts have been really wiped out or severely downsized. In addition, of course, on the earned side, what you've seen is where people are unemployed or they're anxious about their job prospects, their discretionary spending is less, and attendance has been affected as well. So the earned side of the equation is down, and it's just a really difficult time. Artists who we talk to say, what this means for me is fewer people are booking new work. When I do get booked, they want shorter time frames, or instead of booking me for 2 weeks, they'll book me for a week or for half a week. They want me to pay more of my expenses up front. If you're in the theater business especially, people are producing smaller cast plays because the number of actors is the major place where you save money or you don't save money. For playwrights especially, what you hear from playwrights is, there's no point in me writing a play right now with more than three or four people because who can afford to produce it? And so the economy is really impacting the fortunes not only of artists, but in a sense, the larger artistic vocabulary that people are working under. The caveat we put under this, though, is that while the economic impact is real, in national conversations we convened at Doris Duke in 2006, which predates the economic downturn, we already heard audiences are falling in the theater field. We already heard technology is having a huge impact on our business in ways we don't understand yet. We already heard audiences are behaving in ways we don't understand. We already heard we're having trouble getting younger people in the theater. And so what we're always at pains to remind people is the issues that the theater field is facing long term were not caused by the economy. The economy exacerbated those issues, but the real challenges predate the economy. If we only focus on the economy, the solutions that we arrive at aren't going to serve us for the long term.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think, yeah, I think you're definitely on the right track. I think the mode of the performance artist world has to change a little bit because of the various reasons, because of the economy and because of technology. Last year, just a prime an example, we had a – I'm going to put you on the spot, D, but do you remember that – the gentleman we talked to who used Twitter during his performance?
Yes.
And that would be...
you're putting me on that spot.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name off the top of my head. No, I can't.
But
talked to him at SCTC.
Using technology. Kind of like during the performance, he had a balcony, and they would put the Twitter users in the balcony, so they would accept, you know, and follow the theater, and they would, you know, tweet production history notes or, you know, decision notes or director notes or that sort of thing throughout the performance as it was live in front of the audience. And I thought that was kind of a neat way to kind of try to embrace technology and merge the worlds a little bit, you know?
You know, it's an interesting dilemma for people. I absolutely agree. You know, on the one hand, when we had those conversations, there was a teenager probably in California or somewhere who said basically, look, sitting in the dark for 2 hours, unable to talk to my friends either verbally or electronically is not my idea of a good time.
Yeah.
And which I thought, you know, that's absolutely true for that generation. At the same time, a number of theaters are dependent on subscribers who love going into a space where the lights are turned out, where there is a kind of silence, where they're pulled out of themselves into an experience, and they deeply resent the intrusion of technology into the audience space. And if you're a theater producer, how is it you juggle the conflicting expectations and desires of those two generations in the same space at the same time?
Mm,
I mean,
right.
it's a conundrum for people. You know, for us, I think part of what we're really aware of right now is that there's a larger recalibration of culture and communications in this country right now. It is killing the newspaper industry, as we know. 24 of the top 25 papers in the United States experienced dramatic shortfalls in circulation this year. Tower Records is gone, and how music is distributed is totally different. Borders has declared Chapter 11 this year, and there's a lot of fear that the book publishing industry is headed for a thing of the past. I mean, we're at this seismic redefinition of how we communicate and what culture means, and we can't expect the arts to stay above and beyond that. But for performing arts especially, what we know is one of the great things about the Internet is you can get anything you want any time of day, delivered to your own house. So you can shop at 3 in the morning or 8 at night, which is fantastic. If you're a performing arts organization, you have to be at that theater at that time or it doesn't happen.
Right,
you have to travel, you have to park, you have all that inconvenience. And especially right now in a time when young people, especially again, download culture on demand 24 hours a day for 99 cents a song or for free, how are they going to respond when we say that theater ticket is $85, $95, $105? So it's remaking the economic structure for the arts as well in profoundly problematic ways that we don't know how to work our way through yet.
Right. It's very true. And it's not just a matter of incorporating that technology. And by the way, I did a little bit of homework while you guys were chatting. I looked it up. It's Scott Hayes from Regent University. I did some research on that. That was my Fox News research that I did there on that.
Breaking corrections
as we go along. Yeah, there
see
you go.
How technology's just remade your life right there. Right there. You can Google during a conversation.
That's it. Sad thing is, I went to our own website to do that. Isn't that bad? That was an internal thing. life in a loop.
I actually loved that article the other day that, I don't know if you even saw this, it was totally off the subject, but about how time has passed Harry Potter by, but how young kids now who watch the Harry Potter movies, who watch Hermione in the library going through books after book after book looking for dark secrets and turn each other now to the movie theater and go, why doesn't she just Google potions?
Right.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. Wow.
And even the little kids don't understand why you'd be in the stacks in the library.
Yeah.
Anyway. Mm.
That's sad.
As you were saying.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's not just a matter of incorporating, because if you incorporate the technology into the audience, much the way that Scott did at Regent, with, you know, the Twittering during the show and all of that kind of stuff, then you're going to alienate the people who that is a distraction to, you know,
correct.
And then and vice versa. And so you it's a fine balancing act. But then the other part of that too is that how can we take what we do and make it more immediate? You know, I mean, it's like you said, it's not just a matter of being able to go and shop, you know, at home. Now you can go and shop, you know, sitting at the bus station on your iPhone or whatever. You know, you can download that content. I mean, geez, we're sitting at restaurants now, and my son who is six, now we're sitting at tables, and he'll go, I want to watch Netflix, and so we'll flip the phone over, turn on Netflix, and he can stream watching whatever cartoon he wants on the iPhone. I mean, it's that kind of thing. And it keeps him happy, you know?
Yep.
You know?
It's an amazing world. I mean, the bright spot, I think, that most people in the arts are seizing is that even while traditional arts attendance is dwindling, arts participation in terms of people that either write their own works or write their own compositions or play their own musical instruments or paint their own pictures, arts participation is exploding in this country at an exponential rate. And so I think a lot of what artists are starting to ask is, how is it that I can insert myself into this arts participation movement rather than thinking of myself solely in terms of product consumption? And what does it mean if I really start thinking in terms of, what if my piece is designed to be a springboard for my audience's own creative expression rather than this product to just watch and then forget? So it's a total mind shift switch or evolution that I think we're beginning to see in this country about how we have to think differently as an arts community if we want to really thrive into the future to the same degree that the last century allowed us to prosper.
Wow. That's an amazing concept. That it really is. It's so far-fetched from everything that I – this is where I sound like my dad. That's so far-fetched from everything that I've ever been – the way I've ever thought of it, you know. You go, you sit down at the theater, you go, you watch the show, you know, you stand up on stage, you recite your lines, you do your thing, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Not that there's not a place for that, but it does have to adapt. I mean, we've got to learn to change it.
It's absolutely got to adapt. Yeah. They have to drop out of, you know, into a smaller house.
Adapt to survive, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and I think people that are doing this really smartly recognize that really the shift isn't that we get rid of traditional performances, but we recognize it's a piece of a spectrum of experience that somebody wants to have. And what's the surround? How do you surround that piece with other more fertile things that the audience can access as well? You know, clearly there are things to talk back for audiences, et cetera, but I'm really interested in programs like in Baltimore, the Baltimore Symphony's launched a program called the Rusty Musicians Program, where people that used to play musical instruments can audition, and they do concerts now at certain points of the year where the orchestra plays alongside non-professional musicians who they call the Rusty Musicians, who have trained with them, who have taken classes with them for 2 weeks. They pack the place in. Everybody comes and wants to see their friends. They're getting a whole new audience in there. Mm-hmm. They're encouraging practitioners in a new way. They're having a big explosion in terms of people that want to take class with the symphony. that doesn't mean that the symphony doesn't continue to do traditional Beethoven or whatever on other evenings. It's just they now recognize the role they're going to play is bigger than just that concert format they used to do.
Right.
Right. That's, I think that's a key fun, thing. I mean, I think you've got to tear down that. It, like they're doing, you know, I think you got to tear down that us and them kind of mentality.
Yeah.
And find a way to make the theater or the arts venue or whatever a community strong effort. Like I think they're doing out there with their outreach program. I think that's a wonderful idea.
Totally.
So how does this turn around then and bring us into SETC? Now, I understand your undergraduate was North Carolina Chapel Hill. Are you a North Carolinian or a Southerner by birth?
I am indeed. Once a Southerner, always a Southerner. Yes, I was born in High Point, North Carolina, which used to be known as the furniture capital of the world, and for the current generation is more likely to be known as the birthplace of Fantasia Barrino, the American Idol.
That's good. They could be coexist, you know, if you have a big billboard. Welcome to High Point, home of.
Even Fantasia has to sit down.
True.
That's very, yes.
And what a prophetic and profound statement that is.
maybe that could be the title of her next autobiography.
I think that's
even Fantasia has to sit down. The story of Fantasia Barrino.
You need to write. Write that down. I recorded it. Yeah, that's great. Well, heard it here first, folks.
Exactly. You're right. I did go to Chapel Hill, and actually, my first paying theater job was in an outdoor drama in North Carolina. I don't know how well you know the world of historical dramas, but there are a series of dramas performed all over the country, but dominantly in the Southeast and in the sort of Southern West, which are historic pageants. They typically have casts of anywhere from 150 to 250 people. And I was part of a show called Unto These Hills in Cherokee, North Carolina, which is a play that covers about 100, begins with, who is the explorer who discovers the Cherokee Nation, goes entirely through the seizing of the Cherokee land, marching them off to Oklahoma, and then it comes back to 50 years later when some of them are allowed to return to the North Carolina hills. So in 3 hours, you get about 300 years of history with a cast of 250 people and a mountain that lights up at the end.
Wow.
And I got paid for this. So
there you go.
There you have it.
That's all that matters.
So what day do you speak? I don't have it framed, but what day is it that you speak for the SETC folks?
I'm actually speaking twice. I'm doing a keynote session on the Saturday. I don't have my calendar in front of me either. I'm doing a keynote session for the general group, and then there's an awards ceremony and a dinner on Saturday evening. And at that point, I'm also speaking, even though those two addresses, at least as planned right now, are on very different topics and designed for very different audiences.
Ah. So what are your two topics, if you don't mind my asking?
A lot of what I'm going to talk about in the afternoon is really this question. Some of the questions we've been talking about today about what is it we should be paying attention to in this moment? How is it that as the arts community, we should think about this? How do we begin to get from where we are now to where the world actually is calling us to be? And what does that mean for especially the young people who tend to be very heavily in representation at SETC, not only because there's a large academic contingent of SETC, but frankly, SETC is also the place where many of them audition for those summer jobs, so there's a big student population there. So that's the afternoon. Actually, I think in the evening, at least as I think about it today, but I may change my mind tomorrow, I think I'm going to talk about what it means to be a Southerner, and in terms of, as a Southerner, what we know as Southerners about the arts and the theater in particular.
See, that's another conversation that we need to have, I think, at another time. That I think that's a whole other. We could spend hours on that right there alone.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we could all, you know, what I find here in the Nashville market is that it seems like if you're a singer, if you're a musician, you know, that is a profession. But if you're an actor, it's a hobby.
Right.
You know?
Oh, that's like, interesting.
Yeah. It's, well, in Nashville, that's
mentality.
That's true. You know? That is very true.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, I mean, speaking totally personally, my granddaddy was an Appalachian country doctor who basically did a lot of his business by barter, you know, quite frankly, and who was in Ripley's Believe It or Not for delivering his 6,297th baby on his 92nd birthday. I mean, he was one of those.
Wow.
And I grew up in a culture and a legacy that prized storytelling in the spoken word. Mm. And when I think of Southern writers, there's something about language and story that is uniquely regional and profoundly poetic that I think is a doorway into theater for a lot of us from the South who found our way from listening to those stories to enacting those stories. Mm. And I think part of the generosity spiritually you learn as you listen to those stories, if you listen well, is part of the generosity you need in order to direct or to act or to be able to receive the stories that you see on stage.
That would be a fascinating conversation. I wish I was going to be at SETC this year for that alone right there now.
Wow. Well, come on down.
Well, I would. I've got a show opening.
I'm
going to be telling a show this season. This year, I've got a show opening on SETC weekend. Of course, the one year that I can't. That's a shame. Oh well.
What's the show and where are you opening?
I'm directing a show called Phantom. You might have heard of it. it's the musical Phantom. I'm directing it at Missouri Western State University. It's my first production here, actually. I just started professing here back in August. So.
Congratulations!
Thank you. So
that's fantastic.
Yep, yeah, it's going to be a monstrosity. So it is a gargantuan production. It is a huge thing. But it's
casts of thousands.
It's a Cecil B. DeMille production. it really is. But it's a lot of fun and. Everybody on campus pretty much has come out to support what we're doing, and we have a president on campus who has made it his mission to grow an arts program on campus despite everything else that's going on with budget woes and everything else around the state, and for that we're very thankful. So can't complain
God
too much.
God bless your president.
Yes, absolutely. He's a heck of a guy.
No,
you were in Nashville. I'm sorry.
Yes,
did you say you were in Nashville before this?
I was, yeah. John and I actually were both we were both in Murfreesboro, just south of Nashville, before this, and then moved to St. Joseph, Missouri, back in August.
Got it. I trust you realize Murfreesboro is extremely well represented in American Idol this year so far, as I'm sure you're tracking. Yeah. But if for any reason you ran across an actor or singer named Carol Ponder, does that name anything to you in Nashville?
It does. Sort of
rings
ring
a bell. Yeah.
Yeah, well, just on the off chance, because she was another one of the, and there's a whole Nashville contingent that does Under These Hills every year, so I thought maybe you'd know some of those people.
Her name rings a bell.
Anyway.
One last final question. If I were going to ride a bike between Minneapolis and Chicago,
yes,
what brand of bike should I ride?
Oh, my God. I would really... I'll tell you what I rode, and I'm really glad I did. I rode what was called a hybrid bike, which was a sort of halfway point between a mountain bike and a racing bike. The racing bike wheels were a little too thin and went flat a little too easily, and the mountain bike was a little heavy. Even more than what kind of bike you wanted to ride, I would just make sure you had a gel seat rather than a hard saddle, and that you had plenty of lanolin for a chafing. Those are the secrets you learn on those 500-mile rides. It's about the seat and the lanolin. It ain't about the bike.
That is awesome.
Now, you've done that twice for fundraising for AIDS research, correct?
I did. I did that. Before I moved to New York in the mid-90s, I lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And while I lived there, there were two of those rides that I did. So I think that was 96 and 97 I made those rides, which were fantastic experiences. I mean, 2,000 people riding 500 miles together for a cause they believe in. And actually, the single greatest story about fundraising I ever learned, I learned on that ride from an 18-year-old kid.
Oh, well, you have to share that now.
Okay, well, here's the bottom line. I mean, when you did the AIDS rides, there were two rules that could not be broken. One rule was you had to be 18 years old or older for liability issues. The other rule was you had to raise $2,500 minimum or you didn't go. So if you raised $2,499, we were sorry, but you stayed home. And I was riding one year in Wisconsin beside this 18-year-old kid who I always say who was struggling to keep up. And I looked over at his wheels, and his wheels were this blur of sort of yellow. And I said, what in the world do you have on the wheels of your bicycle? And he said, well, they're Post-it notes. I mean, not cards, because when I grew up, we put playing cards on our spokes with clothespins so they'd make noises like motorcycle. But these were those yellow Post-it notes that were bound around spokes with rubber bands. And I said, so what is that? Why in the world? And he said, look, I'm 18 years old. I've never raced a dime in my life. This ride was really important for me to do. And most of my friends aren't used to giving to charity. But then I said, I got this idea that if you gave me $150, I would make you a spokesperson. And every post-it note is the name of a different person who gave me $150. The kid went on to say, I'm taking my donors on the ride with me by virtue of their names. When I get to Chicago, I'm taking the wheels apart and I'm mailing every donor his or her own individual spoke. That kid raised more than $17,000.
Wow.
And I've always just thought, if an 18-year-old kid who has never raised in a dime in his life can raise $17,000 for something he passionately cares about through his creativity and imagination, there is nothing that a properly motivated arts professional or arts board of directors can accomplish if they set their minds to it.
That is, thank you for sharing that. That is awesome.
Sure.
That is an incredible story.
He was an incredible kid.
To say the least. To say the least.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We ran well over your 10 minutes. I apologize, but thank you guys.
Not well worth it. Not at all. Not at all. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Hey, T.
Yeah.
When we don't have guests in studio, how do we talk to them?
Interesting question, John. We use a program called Skype.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What is that about?
Well, it's a piece of software that you can download it. It's free to download. You can use it to talk to other Skype users over the internet for free, or you can make cheap phone calls to phones and mobile phones worldwide through the Skype Out program.
Okay, and how would I, perchance, acquire Skype?
Well, what you can do is you can go to inexplicabledumbshow.com and click on the download Skype button on the left-hand side of the page.
It's as easy as that?
It's as easy as that.
Wow. I'll go do that right now.
If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show like I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow. Hey, actors, you want to set up a website that's not just a MySpace account?
Yeah, use your name as your domain name.
Check out DreamHost. It's easy to set up.
And because you're a listener of the Inexplicable Dumb Show, you get a special treat.
That's right. Go to www.dreamhost.com and enter this special code, IDS, all capitals.
You will receive two domain names with your web hosting package purchased from DreamHost.
But only if you use the promo code IDS.
And remember to use all caps on that. Just another way you get buzzed by the Inexplicable Dumb Show.
So we'd like to thank Ben Cameron for joining us on this episode of the Inexplicable Dumb Show. You can find more information about SETC at setc.org. If you'd like to make a comment about our production, our shows, you can call 615-866-1282, or you can drop us an email at podcast@inexplicabledumbshow.com. More next week. Hey, we'll see you. Bye.
Blueberry. This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No E's. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Blueberry.com.
Pop Alternative Media.